Thanks, Jan.
Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, Minister Michael Healy-Ray's Storm Éowyn report card, walking the land in Kildare, a Noah's Ark for the Ash in Carlow, a milk urn time capsule unlocked in Balls Bridge, and the spindle tree turns red. Good to be back. Great to have gotten the treat of spending the last couple of Saturday mornings lying in bed listening to Countrywide. Thank you very much, Ella, for such sterling work. A nice treat, but great to be back out and about on farms again as well. I tend to forget in this job that I get to do something that very few people are able to do. Visit farms. If you live on a farm, it doesn't sound like a big deal, obviously, but relatively few of us do live on farms and fewer still know that much about how it is that they actually work. And if you have even a passing interest in what it is that you put into your mouth three times a day at the dinner table, then visiting a farm at least once is probably quite a good idea. So, to that end, the ever innovative people at Farming for Nature have asked 21 of their farming ambassadors all around the country to open the gates to the public tomorrow for guided farm walks. And if you were to choose, for example, to visit Norman at Dunn's Egg Farm in County Kildare, this is a little taste of what you might learn.
We've 900 hens and the egg production varies
depending on time of year.
Time of year and heat. They don't particularly like that hot heat that we've had the last couple of weeks. They're enjoying the soft ground there now, as you can see there. We've had rain last night, so it softens up the ground for them to scratch. But we produce anywhere between 700 and 800 eggs.
Why do you choose the Pyrenean Mountain Dog for flock protection?
It's in their nature. Like it's in their nature to protect. Hens climb their backs, they peck them, they do everything, and they just sit there and take it, you know.
What role do they play in soil health?
Oh, it's huge. Like their poop is fertilizer. Their feet are, they're like little tilling machines, gentle tilling machines, as opposed to rough machinery tilling. As you can see there, they're scratching out, they're levelling, they're creating new seed beds for new seeds to come up.
When you move the hens on from here, what will you take out of this?
Probably be spring barley next spring.
Your inputs will presumably be
reduced. Our nitrogen would be an awful lot less than what it was. And we're back on nitrogen anyway as a result of the system of farming that we're in. But
look at her hopping up on his back. And Bruce doesn't mind at all.
Not at all, no.
Fair play, Bruce. You're very patient, particularly if I had jaws your size. Oh, look at him. He's a pet.
Yeah.
Ooh, a pet.
Yeah.
Are these for your own table or is there a commercial aspect?
I have a certain number of people that take a full pig, and then predominantly it's for our own household, and my parents' household is next door as well. So three brothers and three sisters that equally partake in the eating as well. So.
And what role do they play in the ecology of the farm?
They're gentle movement of soil. They're here, they're taking down vegetation here, they're rooting up ground.
Because we're in a little plot of about an acre, which is thick with docks at the moment, and thistle as well. That'll all be gone.
It will, of course.
Before long, will it?
They only get a week in each paddock as well, so...
Basically, weed control.
Yes, well, weed control and look, they're doing their thing.
Are they fun? I've always thought that pigs have such personality and are so clever that they must be fun to farm.
They're very clever, yeah. They're fun and they're frustrating at the same time.
Like herding cats?
Worse, I'd say, yeah. But they follow food, so you can see our fencing is temporary. It's electrified temporary, but they're very clever at rooting up the soil up to the fence to earth it so that the sting has gone out of the fence and they just walk through it then, so...
So not only weed control, but amateur electricians as well have figured out how to earth an electric fence.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
The larger part of Norman's farm is devoted to tillage. Some years back, he adopted regenerative techniques, some of them under our feet as we walk. Chopped straw, providing a blanket for the soil, stopping it getting baked by the sun or washed away by the rain.
And before you went to regenerative, what was your soil like?
Slabby, lifeless, dead is all I could say. The organic matter had been burnt out of it from continuous cultivations, continuous overusage of herbicides and pesticides. So
was that pricking at your conscience?
Yeah, would have done, yeah, yeah.
And was that what motivated you then?
Yeah, it was initially, and the lack of earthworms. Earthworms are a great sign of healthy soil. It's the first sign that you're moving in the right direction.
I asked Norman, could we see the river running through his fields? There had been an enormous downpour of rain an hour before I arrived, and if the regenerative techniques weren't working, the river would be cloudy with soil washed away off the field. For a stream that is right beside a tillage operation, that really is very, very clear.
It's very clear, and it's clear all throughout the year, from our part anyway.
And presumably you're in the River Liffey catchment here, are
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So anybody living in Dublin who's in the business of ever drinking water should have an interest in what it is that you're doing on this farm to keep this river like this.
100%. Yeah. If we don't mine the soil, we won't be able to sustain the current agricultural practices.
Because we're absolutely focused on the amount of nitrates in rivers at the moment.
Nitrates but of and course, phosphorus, yeah, yeah.
But one of the other measures of the health of a river is the amount of sediment in it.
That comes into the soil erosion. People don't believe that that happens in Ireland, but it very much does. The cover crops that we grow, they're the icing on the cake to tick all those environmental boxes that they keep the soil in the field, to keep the nitrate in the field, to keep the phosphorus in the field, and any other available nutrient, they'll take it up into the vegetative growth that it produces and locks it there. It doesn't let it run off out into the river.
Is there a wildlife dividend as well?
Absolutely,
are you seeing more birds as a consequence?
Absolutely, yeah. Every year there's a new species that I've never... Maybe I haven't been tuned into it, I don't know, but there's always a new bird on the farm that we haven't seen. Like the cuckoo was back the last 3 years. I never heard a cuckoo growing up, so...
Really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And have you the big apex predators as well?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the main sign that everything below it is working. So you have the kestrels, buzzards... You'll see them out when you're working. Say if we bale straw or we have to cultivate a field, you'll see them. They'll follow the machinery and they'll pick out frogs or they'll pick out mice or shrews or whatever they're getting at.
Is it a more enjoyable farm to farm on as a consequence of all of this?
100%. Yeah, I feel like we have more control over our farm now than we ever did because we essentially make the decisions on the agronomy of the crop and the fertilisation of the crop. So we have full control over what we do.
Have you effectively taken back a little bit control by releasing control to nature and letting nature be your partner?
Absolutely, yeah.
Norman Dunn on Dunn's Egg Farm outside Maynooth. And you can visit him tomorrow and 20 other farms in Counties Tip, Wexford, Mayo, Roscommon, Clare, Cork, Kildare, Kilkenny, Galway, Kerry, Leash and Limerick, all of whom are applying cutting-edge nature-based science to producing food while making space for nature as well. The event is called Inside the Gate. You can get tickets for free from the Farming for Nature website. Later on in this morning's programme, we're going to be speaking to Minister Michael Healy-Ray about the work that he's doing in the department to support foresters in the aftermath of Storm Éowyn.
But choosing forestry as a land use was always traditionally much less attractive for farmers. If you were to listen, though, to John Normanly, you might think differently. If you go down to his woods in Ballinacurry, County Sligo, you're sure to see all manner of wildlife, birds like jays, tree creepers, sparrowhawk, owls, red squirrels, badgers and bats. Together with his wife Maria, John has worked for more than 20 years to transform his 14-hectare farm into a mixed forest with mostly oak trees, some larch and spruce and some beech trees. As they walked and talked, Lorna Siggins discovered how John made the decision to move from farming to forestry.
This is a spindle tree.
This one here?
Yeah, it's a native tree.
Mm-hmm.
The leaves go red in the autumn. It's pink, the bright pink for the husk on the outside, and the seed itself is bright orange, glaring orange, and it opens out and you can see the seed and the husk, which is pink. And it's the most lovely tree you could have.
You don't see too many of them, do you?
No. Everyone thinks it must come in from some other country. No, it's native Irish tree.
Spindle tree.
Spindle, yeah. I believe they made spindles of them back once upon a time. But it likes the ground fairly good, but it's amazing. I have a lot of it around in different areas of the forest, and it seemed to grow away. The ermine moth, spindle ermine moth. This is his host. So the moth lays the egg on the spindle tree. The caterpillars come out from the eggs and they hang in a purse out of the tree. A big lot of them in a kind of web hanging down. And above all birds, the cuckoo loves the caterpillar. We had them at the house. If he made a hole in the web, they'd all go onto the ground and the cuckoo would be round about the ground eating, and he'd fly away as we'd pass out and come back again immediately. So there's a link between the ermine moth, the cuckoo and the spindle tree. And we only found out that from planting a tree.
It's a whole ecosystem.
Yeah. And he used to perch on the railing outside our house every morning, shouting away because he had his load of food beside him.
He's happy.
If you plant a tree, it changes that area of the world, yeah. And oak has other stories too, but this one has a story that I didn't know. I was ill as a young man when I was just getting into farm when I was 19. I started full-time farm when I was 16, 17, and I spent 6 weeks in hospital to find out what was wrong, and I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I was sent off to Dublin, to St. Luke's, up to the cancer hospital. And as a young fella, that's not the best place to be going, if you could help it. And I had a year or so of chemo and radiation after, a year or two. And then at one stage, I was brought up from home here in Sligo in an ambulance straight up to St. Luke's. I was anointed, the whole lot, and I was fairly sure that was it. And I was on my own. The family were here at home, of course, with no care at home. But I thought, that's it. I've lived to 22. Others lived to be 80, 90 if they're lucky. And I got 22 years and I'd done whatever I could. I thought that night that was it. And I woke up the next morning and there was a magpie hopping across the lawn of St. Luke's. And I thought, I'm going to live. Ever after that, I began to farm organic years later. And I thought, why not? I'm here once. And then planted the farm into oak and other trees. Life is so fragile and it goes so quick. We owe it to ourselves and to our family and people to do the good thing and not be hesitant about it. And just to go, if it's a good thing, nothing should stop it.
Right.
Nothing ever did after that.
At that time, John, there wouldn't have been many people either farming organically or into broadleaf trees.
The advice was, this is crazy,
And what kept you going?
I suppose back to Luke's again, old St. Luke's and isolation ward. And that was my main spring. That nearly there was larch mixed with birch trees.
Mm-hmm.
And with the storm on the 24th of January, the famous day, it knocked all the lurch to one. There's one lurch, you can see it. They crashed down.
How many did you lose?
from the spruce and from, it's going into thousands of trees, and with 2,000-3,000 trees altogether.
You did?
Yeah.
You must have been heartbroken.
Yeah, the first days, yeah, it was, I went down to the spruce and the larch down at the bottom, and the smell, the air was thick with the smell. You know, if you cut a tree, you'll get a nice smell of it. And the air was laden with the smell of smashed trees. And it's nature that will put them there, and this is the other edge of nature.
Right.
And the beach, there's about a hectare here of beach.
Okay.
There's some of the cherries there, the bird cherry and the wild cherry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you plant every one of these trees yourself?
Well, yeah, 40,000 trees at the time in one springtime. But I had a man helping me to do it. And at one stage we got in two or three others when the push was on really bad at the end. But there was one man with me, PJ Durkin, he's a local man. Yeah, he was really good. So the two of us stuck into it from the 1st of February, we put in the first one and right into May. But flat out, it was really busy.
And about 40,000 trees in that time?
About 40,000 trees, yeah.
So 10,000 trees a month?
I was young. I thought
younger.
I was, yeah.
It's incredible.
John Normanly talking to Lorna Siggins there. That'll give you an idea of how emotionally invested some foresters are in the woodlands that they planted themselves. A conversation we'll pick up the threads of later on with Minister Michael Healy-Ray. But just let me add, John and Maria won the RDS Silvicultural Excellence Award earlier this year. And if you want to visit the woodland in Ballincurry, they welcome visitors to their self-catering Hawthorn Farm Cottage. More, as I said, after these.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
And now Michael Dillon has today's livestock news.
Good evening. Now, the cattle trade today is generally tending to be a bit quieter at all at the sales. I have quite a lot of sales here, so I'll run through them fairly quickly. In Portumna, there were 740 cattle on offer, and trade was quieter. Prices there were down by £4 to £5 a 100 kilos for bullocks, and the heifers were down in some cases by more, particularly the store heifers.
Ah, the sound of this programme's ancestor, Michael Dillon, on RTE's Farm Diary in 1988. In that year, the Guild of Agricultural Journalists put together a time capsule in a milk churn. Inside, they placed articles of the day from the main Irish newspapers and from the farming press, plus brochures for machinery and that piece of radio archive and others. This week, the padlocked churn was opened in the RDS at a gathering of agricultural journalists, many of whom were around in the 80s, some of whom have been born since. Suzanne Campbell was there to compare back then with now.
Farmers Monthly's first out. Farmers Journal, dated July 1988. The audit, how he wants it, circulated. Charlie was still ruling the roost back then.
Keep digging, Mike.
What have we got here? Letter from the president of the Irish Country Women's Association.
A Ford brochure, tractor.
Ford Series 10, the four-cylinder tractor, 76 to 103 horsepower. 400 horsepower would be more normal now.
Michael Patton from the Guild of Agricultural Journalists tells me what else was pulled from the depths of the milk churn.
There were reports by the predecessors, the Chagas. There was different letters and predictions by different journalists about where we were at and where we were going. Absolutely fascinating. And really interesting just how accurate some of it actually was in terms of forward predictions.
What were the things that struck you that people really identified was going to be part of the farming and food landscape in the future?
I paid particular attention to Tom Arnold's paper because when he looked forward, he talked about the impact of environment and climate as something that farming would have to deal with. He also talked about the IT revolution and how that was going to play a very major role in how we farm in the future. And all of those things have come to pass. In 1988, as this churn was being put away, patents were being lodged in the US for precision agriculture using GPS systems. And these have now become the mainstay of how we look at so many aspects of our production.
John Commons, originally from Kilkenny, is very well known as one of the producers of Ear to the Ground, which began back in 1993. But in 1988, John was making educational videos for farmers for ACOS, now Chagask. What does he see as the biggest change since the churn was put away?
I think the social end of farming, when you look at, I could look at my own village I come from, where we would, you know, I've had a lot of families, average kind of farms, maybe 40 or 50 or 60 acres, guys with 20 or 30 cows. If you look at the same area now, you have about four farms with 200 cows, including my own family, and you have very few people in the sense in the farming thing.
Yeah.
So it's become a very, very different lifestyle. And probably, I mean, if they're in dairying, if people are making a decent living. The other side of it, I suppose, is that the other enterprises. Back in 1988, you know, you had a lot of good sheep farmers. You had a lot of good tillage. You had everything, really, a fairly wide variety. Now they're effectively redundant to a large extent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a massively different world.
Stella Meehan, editor of AgriLand, remembers the 1980s too, and for her, some aspects of farming haven't changed that much at all.
Well, actually, some of the things are very, very similar. We were part-time bee farmers, and my dad had a huge issue with TB, going down with TB a lot. We're in 2025 now, and TB is still a massive issue for dairy and bee farmers in this country. So in that sense, a lot hasn't changed.
Yeah.
But in another sense, I think that the difference that I grew up, when I grew up in the 80s, it was very much rural life. You know, small tractors, local farmers. Farming was a way of life rather than considered an enterprise. It was a way, certainly, of making a living, but like it was just a way of life living in the country. Whereas nowadays it has evolved very much and it has really become an enterprise, a business within itself. Things have become, you know, bigger as farmers became more educated as well. You can see the change in farming practices, even in my home area. You can see the improvements farmers have made over those years and the change that they've made for the better as well.
One thing that was very obvious coming out in looking at the pieces coming out of the churn, they were nearly all male voices. Now, you're a journalist with AgriLand. That visibility of women in the room today that wouldn't have been there in 88.
No, that's absolutely true. And I've been a journalist a long time, but an agri journalist specifically for a shorter period of time. And when I first went into it, there is an intimidation there, you know, because you walk into a room with 300 farmers in it and you're probably the only woman there. Maybe there might be one other woman. And that's still the case today. However, in agricultural media in this country, full of women. Look at Chagask, look at Borbia, look at Ornua. And I think that they're getting more of a voice, particularly over the last 15 years.
Farming has changed since 1988, and so too has media coverage, with Dr. Claire McCormick from UCD researching how farming coverage has declined in the main newspaper titles in Ireland. She explains why she believes that farming stories matter.
Media is so influential on all our lives. And as the general public becomes more removed from primary agriculture, the media is actually filling those gaps. So people are getting, particularly non-farming audiences, get their information about agriculture from the media. And then that can affect our views, decisions that we maybe make in the supermarket. It can affect policy, actually, in certain directions.
Mm-hmm.
The science shows and has shown for years that media coverage affects how we perceive issues, discuss issues, and how we feel or not mobilised on issues. And when we're trying to work towards more sustainable food systems in Ireland and huge changes on farms, you know, this can affect the speed at which change happens.
Dr. Claire McCormick speaking to Suzanne Campbell at the unlocking of the milk churn time capsule from 1988. Minister Michael Healy-Ray, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Philip.
I owe you a thank you and a sorry straight away. Thank you for making the journey from Killorglin to our Ballyverna studio. And sorry that in addition to all of our other woes in this place, the RTE circuits have been struck by lightning overnight.
Look, these things happen, but you can always get other ways. There's 10 different ways to skin a cat.
There is indeed. And isn't it lucky that you weren't actually in the studio when it was struck by lightning and that you arrived 8 hours after the fact? We're talking about other acts of God, though, this morning. And in the immediate wake of Storm Éowyn, forest owners needed your department to grant them felling licences to deal with all of those windblown trees. Now, you made a statement during the week about how pleased you were with the number of those licences that had been granted. Why was that?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because first of all, I want to thank you, Philip, for the opportunity, because I feel it's my duty to come on a show like yours and what I would call give an account of myself and my department, if you know what I mean, because I'm answerable to the people out there that were so badly affected, and I want to give them what I would call a progress report. So first of all, I want to start off by thanking the head of forestry, Barry Delaney, and others, and all the people in the department who have been working so diligently on these matters. We really put a lot of effort into it, and I just want to give you the following update, if that's all right. Today, like this week, last week, I just want to confirm that 90% of the private and quilta harvesting capacity in the country is operating in windblow sites. So in other words, because of the fact that in one night we had 2.5 years of timber knocked to the ground, well, we've been working very hard to ensure that the farmers that were affected, that their timber is being harvested. In other words, they were given their licences. We're up on 85% of all of that ground now licensed. But what I would say to people out there, because remember, there is 15% that haven't come forward. And I would sincerely
I want to deal with them separately in our conversation, if we could, because that's a very, very important issue you just identified there. But going back to the number of licences granted, in the 7 months since Storm Éowyn, it's 194 licences. Now, I asked your department yesterday how many licences they had granted in the 7 months before Storm Éowyn, and they told me that it was 1,064 licences. So the department has granted 5 times more licences before the storm than since it. You can't be pleased with that.
But of course I am, Philip, because you're missing a very important point. When I was appointed, I identified one anomaly in the whole system. That was, there are 2 licences. There is a licence to thin and there is a licence to clear fell. One of the first things that I did was I ensured that we merged those 2 licences. So in other words, once you had any type of a licence on your forestry, for instance, if you had a thinning licence, you could turn around and use that for felling. So the licences that you're speaking about, I ensured that those licences are being used now for clear felling. So your argument doesn't make sense, to be honest, because the day that the trees fell down on the ground, because of the changes that I made, without anybody applying for a licence, it already meant that 65% of those forest owners, they actually had the right to go in and start cutting that timber right away.
Okay, but of the 666 people who have applied for a licence since Storm Éowyn, how many of those have been granted?
We're turning around the licences now in 100 days, which was unprecedented before. That was never heard of. So licensing, and I really want to make this very clear too, licensing is not a problem at all. Absolutely not. People who want to go away and clear fell their timber now and get it off the ground, the licences are holding nobody up. Absolutely nobody.
Okay, hang on a second.
I'll argue this with you any day of the week. Licences are not a problem, but I do want to identify the problem.
All right, you're right. There are so many problems here, but let's just stick with the licences for one second, because
in May, when we last spoke to you,
you heard from the forester Noel Kelly on the programme that week, and you were very impressed by the point that he made, that how you as minister acquitted yourself on this matter would determine how much confidence people had in going into forestry in the future. Now, so I asked him this week how his own felling licence application was doing.
We applied the latter days of March. I do know they're working on it, because we had an email from them last week looking for further details.
So that's 5 months, and then they came back to you at that stage looking for more detail. Did that disappoint you, or do you think under the circumstances it was to be expected?
I'm kind of pragmatic, you know, enough to know that it was nearer going to be, I was nearer 6 months than four. So it's okay so far.
So yes, Minister, there are licences being granted within 100 days, but there are also licences that are not being granted within that time frame.
But under the Farmers' Charter, you know it's 6 months. We're doing far less than that. We're averaging 100 days. Now, I would never go commenting on an individual case, but I just know for a fact that that case that you were just speaking about has been dealt with by Ecology and will be issued next week. Now, that's well within...
There's good news for Noel Kelly if he's listening
exactly,
in this
yes.
morning. Okay.
But I'm really... And again, I want to thank the ecologists. I want to thank the people inside the department because they're working diligently. But I want to get to a problem that you don't seem to want to talk about, right? And that is, there are 15% of people, of affected forest owners, who have not come forward. Yeah. And I'm really anxious about this because talking about licensing is not an issue because the licenses are holding nobody up.
Absolutely. But, and do you know what, Minister? I spoke to a number of people in exactly that position who have not applied. And the reason they're not applying is because once they do, they're obliged to replant and you haven't told them what kind of support they're going to get for replanting. And their harvesting costs are up 45% and the timber value at the mills has dropped by 30%. So what was a nest egg for them is now a financial liability, and many of them are ashamed to say this, and this is why they didn't want to come on the programme this morning. They're just going to turn their backs on all of that windblown forestry and walk away from it.
No, Philip, to do that would be a financial bad mistake, and I'll tell you why. I have given an absolute assurance that there is going to be a reconstitution scheme that is being worked with as late as this week with the senior minister and senior officials in my department. We've been discussing. We're in the middle of a budgetary process. This will be all coming out in the next coming weeks with the budget and all of that. And we will actually be able to say to those people what exactly they will be getting. But the one guarantee that I have given them is that there is a reconstitution scheme going to be in place.
Okay, but so replanting is going to cost them €4,000 a hectare. And the rumours doing the rounds at the moment among foresters is that the support, the reconstitution scheme, is only going to be half that. Can you offer them a bit of clarity this morning on that?
I can give you clarity in that from the very beginning, I assured people that there would be financial support. I've visited many, many forests of where people, and they know that they're entitled to do this, they can go in, take out their timber, sell it, get the best price they can for it, and there will be money to replant and to help them.
But at the moment, that's going to leave them in debt if they do that.
No, Philip, look, you have to be practical about this. What happened was unprecedented. The actions that we have taken since are very helpful. We've been very clear on this. You must remember that it's not too long ago, if you were looking for a license of any sort, you were waiting for 2 years for it. So this department has done a complete and absolute U-turn in the way that we're dealing with people, in that people are getting a good, quick, sound, fast service. And the other thing that I do want to say to you, and this is important, when it comes to selling timber, I want to again remind people to use reputable people, respectable people, because there are things that I've read in reports and that we've all heard and seem to be backed up by individuals who came forward and told their stories where they would, what I would call, have dealt with people who didn't take care of their requirements. And in other words, left them high and dry.
And ended up in trouble down the line. Okay, good advice, good advice. Now look, the other part of your brief was also the other sector hit worst by Storm Eowyn, polytunnel growers. I've talked to a good number of growers this week. The picture here is mixed. Yes, there are people who did receive grant funding from the department to rebuild and they're very grateful to you for that. But I'm afraid I've also talked to growers who weren't impressed by the scheme at all. They said it was too cumbersome, too long-winded, too slow to help with getting them to produce this season. And they have told you this themselves. Do you think that they have a point?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. This happened in a hurry. We needed to get a scheme opened very quickly, so the scheme was reopened in February 25. That was in response to the storm. We had to do it quickly because these people needed to get to a situation where they could be growing again for this season. Like all schemes, these schemes are subject to terms and conditions, and there is no flexibility in a short time frame to change these. But I do want to give you the statistics. 37 eligible applications were received by the 7th of March, which was the closing date. A total of 33 of those were actually approved for grant aid, and that money has been issued or is being issued to those people. So, I mean, that record in itself is very good.
Well, that's the good news. That's absolutely the good news side of the picture, and credit should be given to you and the department for that. The other side of the picture, though, is Thomas O'Connor in Tralee, a man whom you know, whom you've talked to, small producer, great little business for the last 19 years. He took one look at this scheme, he was telling me, and he decided that it would be easier to go and crowdfund the money than get it from the department.
The scheme that was opened up wasn't really applicable to us because the scale we were looking for support under 7,500. We'd have been required to get planning permission, and we'd have had to it wouldn't be allowed for repairs. There would have to be a new structure.
So how did it feel then to effectively have to rely on the charity of strangers in order to rebuild?
Yeah, it was kind of depressing. it was kind of depressing. It was depressing that we're 19 years in the business and an event like this happened, and then that we weren't able to replace the tunnel ourselves.
Easier to ask friends and neighbours for a dig out than to ask the department for support. That's not a great comment, is it?
But the very point that Tom made there is completely outside of my control. And Tom does excellent work and is an excellent producer. But the fact that the works required planning permission, that's hardly my fault or the fault of the department. All I could do was open a scheme that would operate quickly to give money out quickly to people who are eligible under the terms. Now, if work required planning permission, you know that planning permission for anything takes 8 weeks, a further 4 weeks if people want the opportunity to object. So that's a three-month period. That would have, that is completely outside of my control.
But you also know, Minister, that many people were allowed to put those polytunnels in without planning permission. So then to require them to get planning permission in order to get a little bit of grant relief to rebuild, that was an unnecessary piece of bureaucracy, wasn't it?
But, Philip, it was bureaucracy that I didn't place in front of Tom. Tom said himself that the works required planning permission.
But you could have removed it.
I could have removed it. Well, I don't think under the actual laws that are there present and the legislation that's there, I don't think I could do that.
Okay.
We have an excellent minister with responsibility for planning and a planning department, but my functions don't go into planning. But you would imagine, though, on the other side of this story, Philip, you would imagine that anything to do with agriculture or horticulture, you would imagine that what you just said is correct. But I'm only taking what Tom said himself, and unless you know the actual situation on the ground, you can't talk about another person's business without knowing exactly what was being proposed. But you would imagine that anything to do with those issues would be exempt of planning. But unfortunately, again, there were terms and conditions, and I'm extremely sorry, because I would have only loved to have seen Tom and every other person that wasn't eligible being eligible, but all I could do was deal with the eligible applications and grant them, and I did that, and we did it in
you
a timely fashion.
You did, 33 of the 37 that you received, as you said. Look, big picture question to you, Minister, before we finish. For Ireland's food security, you need to attract people to the horticulture sector. For a plethora of environmental reasons, you also need to attract people to planting forestry. Do you accept that the shaky response of your department to Storm Éowyn might have knocked confidence in both of these areas of your portfolio?
Well, first of all, now, I'm going to take grave exception to what you just said. And I'm not going to allow you get away with saying it. And I would go so far as saying, what planet are you living in to call my response shaky? This response from me and my department has been extremely sure-footed. We set up a task force. We brought together all the stakeholders from all over. We've renewed a confidence in forestry that was never there before, in the middle of a situation where 2.5 years' worth of timber fell on the ground in one night, and at the same time we're turning everything around. And what I'm going to remind you about, in case you don't know about it, this year the total hectares planted and paid in 2025 are nearly double those in 2024. There have been 1,965 hectares of new forest planted and paid to the 22nd of August, and there are another 778 hectares committed. Therefore, this is 2,743 hectares paid or due to be claimed, and there is also another 4,500 hectares approved for planting.
Okay.
And I'm contacting those people at present, asking them and trying to
I'm not going to fall out with you over the use of the word shaky.
Allow me the opportunity to answer you back when you said a shaky start, because that's very unfair to people who are working diligently.
Yes, and there are many people who have
and
paid
I'd like
credit.
You to recognise
There are many people who have paid credit to you, Minister, and what it is that you have done. But I am also, when I use a word like shaky, just reporting to you what other growers and what other foresters have said to me about their feelings about the response of the department. But thank you very much for coming in to Ballyvournia and talking to us this morning, Minister Michael Healy-Ray. I want to move on now to the fungus that causes ash trees to die. It was one that arrived here in 2012. The consequences were devastating. 90% of the population of this iconic tree has died or will die. But we are going to finish on a good news story today, because scientists have been investigating what was going on with the 10% of trees that will remain healthy. And they think they know. And they think that it might hold the answer to how to restore the ash in the Irish landscape. And they want the public's help in identifying the location of these hardier varieties of ash around the country. In Chagask's Oak Park Research Facility in Carlow, Dr. Dheeraj Rathore showed me the ash tree nursery, a kind of a Noah's Ark, if you will. Disease-tolerant trees planted next to diseased trees to test how resilient they are. It's a project that Dheeraj is confident is the first step to the restoration of the noble of the wood.
They're lovely trees, ash trees, when they're
beautiful,
healthy, aren't they?
Beautiful, beautiful trees. They catch your eye from a distance and from close. And you want to stay, you want to feel them. They have beautified our landscape for so many years. They have provided economical timber, ecological benefits, timber for hurling. And losing them is going to be a disaster.
They call me and everything is quite open. We have a dedicated email address.
What is ash dieback?
It's caused by an invasive fungus called Hymenoischiphus fraxineus. Quite mouthful.
We can say fungus.
Fungus, yes. And it blocks the cells, stopping the nutrient and water supply.
Okay. And that fungus is carried on the wind or in a beetle like Dutch elm?
No, it carries by wind. They are microscopic spores which travel with the wind. Okay.
So we're looking at an infected tree now here. What happens to it?
So once the spores land on these leaves, they start growing, causing these brown lesions.
Okay.
Then the disease starts traveling through these twigs and
through
branches,
through the branches,
into the main trunk.
And each cell is getting blocked from transporting water and nutrition.
Yes. The fungus has two phases. One is it grows in the tree, and that happens over the summer months. But from autumn onwards into the winter months, it survives on the leaf litter.
So once the leaf drops off the tree, it falls onto the ground and the fungus can live there over the winter?
Yes, it does survive over the winter in the leaf litter. When the temperatures start picking up in spring, fungus starts growing back again on that same leaf litter.
As a little mushroom.
Yes, a little mushroom. And then it again starts releasing the spores in high number with the wind dispersal. They again land on the leaf canopy, causing the disease.
So isn't it very clever? Ultimately, it doesn't matter to it that it has killed off its host, because it can survive until the summer, until its spores are released and carried on the wind again.
Yeah.
Clever, clever little fungus.
It's the way, I would say, they don't have the brain, but it's just the way they have adapted to survive.
But then there are these tolerant strains. Like, this looks like a healthy tree here.
A healthy ash tree will have a very round green crown with lots of green leaves on it. The tips of the shoots will be looking very vigorous growth. And you can see the, this is all this year's growth. It's all full, very nice green, quite a strong leaf.
And you don't have to be a botanist to be able to look at that and just say, that looks healthy.
You can clearly see. You see just over here, and you will see around everywhere there is ash. Ash is the second most common species. And the dead-looking or the infected trees will look very weakened.
So what do you want the public to do once they have spotted a healthy-looking ash tree?
If the people, general public, has seen a healthy-looking tree, please report it to ashforfuture@chagisk.ie, or you can find more information on Chagisk website.
Take a picture, drop a pin so that you know where it is, and that tree could possibly form part of the genetic seed bank for the future generations of ash.
It will be the part of a breeding program. They will become part of a seed orchard which will produce the seed for future.
Are you being typically cautious, like all scientists prefer to be, and say, no, I can't guarantee you, Philip, that the ash in a generation or two's time is going to be back in the kind of numbers that it was before 2012? Or is there reason for optimism here?
There is definitely a reason for optimism here, and I'm quite optimistic that we will be able to bring the ash back because we have seen how other countries have brought alums back. Spain is working towards it. Netherlands have done it already. And that gives us the optimism that we will be able to breed and produce progenies that will be highly tolerant, and we'll be able to restore. No guarantee over how many generations, but there will be ash back.
If you succeed, the GAA will make you the patron saint of hurling, I think.
I don't want any of that, but I do want to see this beautiful native tree back in plantations, in hedgerows, and in our landscape.
And the more disease-tolerant varieties of ash that we, the great Irish public, identify for Chagisk, the more resilient the ash trees of the future will be. Strength through diversity. The message from Dr. Dheeraj Rathore. ashforfuture@chagisk.ie is the email, or check out the Chagisk website. That's all that we have time for on the programme this week. Talk to you at the same time next week. Have a good weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.